Welcome to Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, where we talk about gospel insights through great stories and help you find entertainment that is both true and beautiful. Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree is part of the Public Square Media Network of podcasts that seek to bring an LDS perspective into the public square. I'm your host, Carl Cranny. I have a PhD in religion, and I'm a Latter-day Saint, and I've written on the intersection of religious themes in pop culture. And joining me today, of course, is my co-host, Liz.
Hi, I'm Liz Busby. I am a writer of science fiction and fantasy, a reviewer of books, and I am now a graduate student in BYU's English program.
Fantastic. We look forward to all the insights you're going to gain and give us because of all the stuff you're doing there. And we have two guests joining us today. Repeat guest is our friend Connor. Connor, go ahead and introduce yourself again.
I'm Connor. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Iowa. All but dissertation now, which I think is a little farther along than I was last time I was here. I do English literature, mostly working with Gothic lit currently from 19th century Britain, and then looking at the post-secular, so thinking about religion, spirituality, and secularity, and what literature has to say about all those things.
And Daniela, our new guest, could you please introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Daniela A. Mera. I'm a fantasy romance author. I live in Mexico, a little bit near Mexico City. I am one of the nominated people for a Whitney Award. I'm a Latter-day Saint, and my background is in teaching and theater.
Congratulations on the nomination for the Whitney Award, and we're glad to have you aboard the podcast. Today is the first half of our Barbenheimer miniseries, so we will be talking about Oppenheimer, the 2023 summer biographical film about the maker of the atomic bomb. It's written and directed by Christopher Nolan and is still in theaters as of the time of recording. But first, our best books segment, where we each recommend one thing that we are watching, reading, or listening to. Liz, why don't you go ahead and get us started this time?
My recommendation today is a book that I spontaneously picked up in the library and had tons of fun with this July. It's called Dinner with the President by Alex Prudholm. And it's been a tradition of mine every July to try to read a book about a president, and I didn't have one for this July. And so I saw this one and it was like, check, I did it. This one is really interesting because it talks about the evolution of cooking at the White House and all of the different White House chefs and the different tastes and styles of the presidents. And then also, of course, famous meals that were served or that were crucial to politics and interesting things like that. So it talks about, of course, the one made famous in Hamilton, the dinner that Thomas Jefferson organized about the Capitol and the federal banking system. And it talks about when the president served King George hot dogs. They needed a prototypical American food, and that's what they picked. It went over well, apparently. Anyway, it's just packed full of really fascinating little anecdotes like that. And just seeing the evolution of cooking over time is interesting, too. The author is Julia Child's grandnephew. So he also has a lot of her insights on that later when it becomes applicable. So it's really fun. I enjoyed it. That's Dinner with the President.
That sounds really interesting. Glad that King George enjoyed the hot dogs. As far as my recommendations, the two that I have is that I started watching Ahsoka. So far, only the first two episodes are out. But for those of you who were really disillusioned with the sequel trilogy, as I was, but I'm happy once again to see Star Wars getting its legs underneath it as far as TV goes with The Mandalorian and The Book of Boba Fett, maybe a little less on that one. But Ahsoka, so far, so good. It was interesting. I watched it late the night that it came out. I was like, I'm just going to watch 20 minutes of this. Okay, the first episode, 60 minutes. Okay, I finished it. I'd start the first 10 minutes of the next episode. Oh, it's over. It was satisfyingly entertaining for me. And so that's so far so good. Another one that maybe is an oldie but a goodie at this point, I did actually finally finish watching Men in Black 3. I just got to say, the delight of that movie is just watching Josh Brolin do a pitch perfect interpretation of Tommy Lee Jones as a younger man. Like, just the rest of the movie made me take it or leave it, but that was just so fun to watch. Anyway, so Ahsoka on Disney Plus and Men in Black 3, wherever you can find that streaming. Those are the two things that I've been watching recently that I thought were fun and worth mentioning. Daniela, do you have a recommendation for our listeners?
So Lately, I just actually finished publishing a rapid release, as they call it. So I publish a book a month for the entire summer. And I just finished that on Monday for the end of the series that came out. So I actually have not been reading as much recently. I was like, oh gosh, I have one book that I did read that it's possible that some people saw, which is Fourth Wing. It is a fantasy romance. There is cursing in this. There's also some, I don't know how you would say it, like lewd activity. I don't know. How would you say it on your channel? That works. There's a little bit in it, but I was actually visiting the US when they had the Straight Edges. It was a really big phenomenon with this author who used to write romance and then ventured into fantasy. It's like Divergent Dragon Rider themes. Cool. I enjoyed it quite a lot. And before we went to see Oppenheimer, my husband and I had just finished Succession, which is, again, one of my favorite shows. It's really good. Again, got some mature content in it, so I wouldn't watch it with young kids or anything, but really enjoyable. I really liked the writing in it. And I think Oppenheimer, for me, one of the reasons I saw it so much is because it evoked a lot of the same feelings and a lot of the same questions that I had watching this thing about rich people who control from the shadows a little bit and how they view the regular people. Watching the final season especially and watching each episode as it came out, it was really reflective. I grew up in the US and like watching from afar the way that things happen and like how people are pit against each other based off of clickbait and news outlets and stuff like that. And the people that control them, they don't care. Like they don't have moral qualms with the things that these places and these platforms are spouting. They're just in it for money. And I thought that was a really poignant commentary on a lot of things that are happening, not even just in the US, but obviously it's focused most on that because it plays a US family that has like a media conglomerate. I don't know if anybody here has seen it. It's very good.
Connor, what do you have to share with our listeners today?
This is what I read finally over the summer. And someone might have pitched it on your show before. It's DJ Butler and Aaron Michael Ritchie's The Cunning Man, which is delightful. It's very Mormon, plays with folk magic set like around the Great Depression in Utah, and follows this beet farmer that also is a cunning man. So he uses folk magic to sort of fight supernatural evils, and it's delightful. Just a great time.
Yeah. Has it been recommended on our podcast before, Liz?
I think I recommended it in one of the early episodes. It's a very unique book. I still need to get to the second one. Have you read the second one yet?
I haven't read the second one yet.
You both read it and then come back on another future podcast. You guys can both recommend it in the mouth of two or three witnesses. We will have links to all these recommendations on our website, popcultureapricottree.com. Buying through these links helps support our podcast so we can keep bringing you conversations about the true and beautiful in pop culture. And as far as plugging another one of our Public Square Media podcasts, this time we're actually not going to plug one of those, but just one that I thought was absolutely fascinating is Angels and Seer Stones with Christopher Blythe, who's a professor at Brigham Young University, and his wife, Christine Blythe. And they just have short little very bite-sized podcast episodes about various sorts of cultural idioms in Latter-day Saint theology and culture and history and thought. It's a delightful little podcast, and we look forward to hearing a lot more from the Blythes moving forward. It's just a podcast I wanted to let you all become aware of because it's fantastic.
I love the episode that they did about pre-birth experiences, like parents seeing their children before they were born. That was really interesting.
I felt like I learned a lot about President Nelson's marriage to his first wife just by listening to her account of seeing their son in a vision before he was born as their 10th child.
If you're interested in hearing more people talk about those sorts of experiences, there's a documentary that's not great, but it felt like Remembering Heaven. And it's all about people sharing these experiences of seeing visions of or having impressions about children before they have been born. And then some cases also where it's a child that gets adopted. So not even like biological children in every case. I think the whole thing's on YouTube with ads for free.
Yeah, we'll get it in the show notes.
All right. And now on to our main discussion of Oppenheimer. I'm going to start us off by saying, and I feel like I might be the negative Nancy a little bit on this one among these four. I liked it. I watched it the whole 3 hours and was never bored. I want to make that clear up front. Christopher Nolan is one of those people. It's a Christopher Nolan movie. Oh, let's go see it. Like IMAX, let's go right now. But I felt like it did suffer from the problem that several of his other films did for me, in that I didn't know what the theme was. Is this just a biopic of Oppenheimer? Is it about the horror of creating atomic weaponry? Is it about the sort of juxtaposition of the scientists doing their things in the lab with the practicality of, are we going to actually drop this on Japan to help end the war? Right? I feel like there were several themes going on, and it didn't really focus on any one of them. And I think that was to its detriment, even though, I don't know, it was a 3.5 hour movie. So maybe if you could turn it into three movies that served each of those sort of themes individually, and that would work out. But it was beautiful. It was haunting. I did enjoy it. Hats off to the actors, who I thought all just knocked it completely out of the park. So I liked it, and yet I thought it suffered from some of those things that Christopher Nolan sometimes does in some of his movies. But I'd be curious to get everybody else's just overarching thoughts before we launch into maybe discussions of individual specific parts. Liz, let's have you go first. What were your overall thoughts on Oppenheimer?
I saw the same things you saw, but I felt the opposite way about them. I expected it to be a much more preachy movie about nuclear weapons, and I liked that it didn't really feel like it had decided what to think about that, or decided what to think about Oppenheimer himself. It leaves a lot of ambiguity and open questions of, should they have invented the nuclear weapons? Should we have dropped them? Is Oppenheimer a good moral person, or is he not? Is this, I can't remember the name of the government guy who's trying to discredit him. Is he a good guy? Is he a bad guy? Maybe that's the only point where it comes down on pretty clearly, this guy is a terrible person. But everybody else is really gray. And I enjoy that. I'm famous in book clubs for hating historical fiction, because all the historical fiction books that book clubs pick are about World War II. And they're all really black and white. And so I enjoyed seeing something that was not as black and white set in that period. So I enjoyed it more than I thought I was going to, actually.
Interesting. Connor, what are some of your high-level thoughts about the movie?
All cards on the table. Right now, it's at like my top of the year. We'll see if it gets supplanted before the year's over.
What do you think coming down the pipe might supplant?
Dude, no.
The biggest challenge is, I think, Scorsese's Killers of the Flower Moon, which I've been really waiting for 3 years or however long it's been about to come out. I think similar to Liz, the thematic complexity or messiness worked for me. I think partially because of the ways that the film largely grounds you in Oppie's point of view, and that the way that he remains largely inscrutable, that you're seeing what he's experiencing, but you still have no idea what this guy is really thinking and feeling about everything. And I think with a different performer at the center than Cillian Murphy, it probably would have fallen apart. But the strength of his performance, I think, really carries that choice. And he's just so magnetic and arresting to watch for me that I was sold. And I have a soft spot for big swings that have messy results. If something is swinging big and executes less well than something that swings less high, executes perfectly, I'll choose the like big swing with messier execution almost every time.
Daniela, what are some of your high-level thoughts before we start jumping into our conversation about specific points and the nitty-gritty of the movie?
Yeah, I guess the atomic bomb is something that's a little, I don't want to say it's close to my heart, but I have a lot of overlap with it, because my grandfather was actually one of the soldiers that was at Ground Zero in Los Alamos. And then we lived in Las Vegas, which they continued to do atomic bomb testing until I was a kid in that area. It was everywhere, like all over the casinos and stuff. They had things named after it. And like the Killers, really big fan of the Killers, which is like a Las Vegas cliche, but they have songs like Miss Atomic Bomb and everything. It's something that's very familiar with for me, especially because my grandfather did die of cancer young. And everybody that he had worked with as well also passed away from cancer as well. In Las Vegas, there was a big initiative when I was younger of people who had died as a direct result of the testing in the Nevada and Utah area. So there was documentaries of people who had family members that did that, like speaking and stuff. I'm going to be honest. When I first saw the trailer, my husband leaned over, "We got to see this." And I didn't know what it was in the beginning because I don't recognize names very well. And then I watched the trailer after and I was like, oh man. And it instantly just cooked me. I did actually read American Prometheus at one point and then reread it a little bit recently as well. It's very long. It's about 1,000 pages talking about his life. I saw the movie several times in 2 languages. We also saw it in Spanish as well. And every time for me, it was a really impactful experience for many reasons, because I think that this is the first time I've ever loved anything that Christopher Nolan said, which I don't know if that's controversial, actually. A lot of people don't like him, but this is the first time I felt so immersed by his storytelling style. And I walked out of it having this sense of awe at the depth of capacity that humans have for creating and creating something good. Maybe some people wouldn't agree with that, but like the music for me was complex. My brother was a cellist growing up and my mom made me play classical instruments as well, but my brother was quite good. He played in like the Las Vegas Youth Philharmonic and things. So I really appreciate scores. Some of the songs I still listen to, like the one that's called Can You Hear the Music that they play at the beginning. There's 27 tempo changes in that. And the composer with his wife like spent years working on it. And the shots, the way that they chose to use the black and white versus color with the two opposing perspectives. I liked the Salieri Mozart aspect of it as well. You owe me, I am better than you, I must become more than you, but it's like such a small perspective. And I also appreciated something that you guys mentioned, which actually didn't stick out to me that much in the beginning. This idea of you never really know what you're supposed to think about Oppenheimer. You never know what he thinks. Like, for example, when at the end, when he's talking and there's the names are going to fail me the whole time, but the fake prosecutor, fake trial thing. And he's like, so when did your moral qualms start? And he has this moment of honesty, or when he's speaking with the president and he's like, I have blood on my hands. That exchange actually did happen. And the president did call him a crybaby, not exactly like that, but things like that popped up throughout his life. And he has these raw moments where you're glimpsing depth. It would be like you have the veil taken away and you can see clearly for a moment. For him, this person that understands things that very few people in the world do, the things that he talks about in there, there are not a lot of people in the world that even have the capacity to truly learn what he's talking about. And he understands that and he understands the morality of it. And to me, that's glimpsing the divine. In some ways, because you're just in awe and you're like, I don't understand that yet. I wish I did. I think that's one of the reasons it drew me in so much is because there's a lot of that within the movie and it's really powerful. I think the storytelling and everything about it just, it hooked me and then it made me fixated for a long time. I did not stop talking about it for at least 2 weeks. Every conversation, every meal was like, I'm in this thing and I thought of this thing this morning or something. Yeah, so.
One thing that I really liked about Oppenheimer was that characterization of him as someone who's very smart and yet very not smart. He trusts that it's going to be totally fine if he's completely just does whatever politically. He doesn't think at all about the practicalities, like he doesn't play the politics game. And universities are full of politics and he just does whatever and he's, oh, that'll be fine with it. It's okay. I just gave money to this. It's not that. And they don't see the nuances, and he doesn't understand that people are not going to see the nuances about that.
Yeah. Because everything about him, from the way that is presented in the movie, and I think that's true as an outsider who never knew him, who's just read or seen about him, I think that rings true to the kind of person he was. Because in the movie, it shows several times, like he didn't stop being friends with people just because he disagreed with them. So his capacity for nuance was fascinating and awe-inspiring because he looked at people from all around and was like, oh, I'm okay with this. And I actually have a lot of comments about, for example, the women that he chose to spend time with and Jean, which were really passed over in the movie for whatever reason. But there were some pretty radical people. Like Jean Whitlock was not only a communist, but she had already a master's degree when they had met and was the daughter of another professor that Oppie worked with. I think he's such a complex person that it rings true to me. There's a line that they have from the interviews, like he's dancing between raindrops, but also he's capable of seeing in between things, like in between space, literally through physics, but in between black and white thinking, which I think is just amazing.
I like your comment that you read the book, and Connor's comment that he appreciates movies that swing for the fences. Only someone like Christopher Nolan could be like, I'm going to take this 1,000-page historical biography and turn it into a 3.5-hour movie, talk about swinging for the fences. So we have talked a little bit so far, just in our general thoughts, about the complexity of the movie. It didn't quite work for me. It sounds like it did for the three of you, but it is certainly in some ways a bit of a dark movie. Obviously, it's a dark topic because we're talking about nuclear war, the possibility of wiping ourselves out. A couple of scenes I thought were really good when they were discussing the possibility of a chain reaction that would destroy the entire planet, a la Ender's Game. We're going to create our own version of The Little Doctor, for those of you who've read the book or seen that movie. It's a movie that I could see people saying, this is too dark of a topic. I don't know why I'd want to go watch 3.5 hours on this sort of thing. We try to talk in our podcast here about movies or TV shows or whatever that are of good report or praiseworthy. How would you all respond to that criticism that maybe this is a dark topic and a dark movie about a complex man and that it isn't of good report or praiseworthy? What would your responses be to that? I'll just throw it to anybody who wants to go.
As a person who's consumed a lot of media and like really is involved in the arts, I appreciate the sentiment behind that article of faith. The thing that I think about it, though, is there's this word that they use in it that's like, seek. We seek after these good things. And I feel like in life, you encounter questionable things all the time. In your life, it becomes the work of the seeker to sift through your life to find meaning. We're meaning makers as humans, but also to sift through the things around you and find truth. Like a seeker, that's an active word. In terms of Oppenheimer and like, why should you go see this? I think it's important to learn about the past. I'm not the best student of history at all times, but I think that defining moments are interesting to look at from like a step back perspective of how that actually happened. But actually is like an introspective thing as well. I think that as humans, when we look at horror, most of the time we learn from it. I have been, in the last few years of my life, a greater student of the Bible, like the context in the Bible and stuff. And the Bible is rated R book. The Bible is heavy. We could say that about the Book of Mormon as well, about our sacred scriptures. There's a lot of things in them that if it was presented to you in modern terms, I think there would be a lot of people that'd be like, I can't look at that. And that article of faith for me has always impressed me of we seek in these spaces, because when you're moving and navigating through the messiness and complexity of things, that's when truth is manifest to you, or when you start to feel the confirmation of truth. When I'm reading through stuff, I often find things that are really heartbreaking and hard, and I want to learn from them, and I want to learn what they have to offer, just like I would in my sacred studies. So when I'm looking through the Bible and I'm reading about genocide, rape, like violation of property, of rights, of person, using things that are bad, what am I supposed to learn from that? Because if we don't understand that our life is not black and white and that we do have to find those things and we have to understand messages and put the disorder into order, then there's not going to be much that we can look at and learn deeply. And there's a scripture in the Book of Mormon, but there's opposition in all things. And so to find great joy, you have to find great grief or anguish or agony. And when we look at people that have caused agony or experienced agony, like how much sweeter is it to learn from them? It's like a convert when they come to church, someone who came from a really rough background that had a really messy life, that was like miserable. And then they find the joy of the gospel and it's like music. It's beautiful. It's order. And the way that they speak about God and finding God, we love that. That's how I feel when I watch things like Oppenheimer, because I feel like the truths that I find in there give me that feeling of not only is this amazing that another human being did this, not only is this godly, this is the power of creation, but there are things for me to learn here that can help me in my everyday life and that can help me bear the weight of living as well.
A slightly different angle on it is, I think, one, it's always important when thinking about art to think through the difference between representation and endorsement, right? So just because something's represented in a work of art doesn't mean that the work of art is endorsing that thing. And you can still have personal lines about what types of representation, regardless of what the position of the art is on the thing being represented, like you want to see or not. But I think the reasons to see Oppenheimer and movies like it, it's like a study in moral character or the lack thereof, depending on how you read him and his legacy. And I think for all of us, those are big, important questions to think about. Do we have moral qualms or moral standards tied to various aspects of our lives? Or do those only seem to come up when it's convenient or there's other things at play? And then how do we justify to ourselves maybe those shifts? For me, the value and one of the really rewarding things about watching and thinking about Oppenheimer is the ways that it provokes those questions and then leaves them unanswered. I then feel brought into the position of wondering, what have I done or what about me is like this? Where am I engaging in a morally dubious way or something? Like the Lord is it I quality that film can have. And that, at least for me, can be very rewarding to prompt that sort of introspection.
So I think we need to like deal with the elephant in the room talking about this on a LDS podcast. This is an R-rated film. And I know Carl and I are in a Discord together, and we had a really heated discussion about whether people would go and see this movie because of the nudity in it. As many reviews said, like, why do we need to see the father of the atomic bomb having sex? I don't know. But I think something you said, Connor, was very interesting because it definitely depicts sex, but it's not endorsing these affairs that he had. In fact, I think this is probably like the least glamorous or objectifying scene that I've seen, even ones that were like clean, fade to black scenes. It just presents it as this is something that was a part of Oppenheimer's life, and it's not trying to titillate the audience at all. It's not trying to make it sexy. It's just like, this was a part of his life. Confront it. And it leaves it with you. Which felt very different to me than my husband and I have been trying to get through the third season of The Witcher. And it's always like, fast forward. It's like constantly about objectifying and titillating me. And I'm like, let's go to the plot. I want the magic plot part. There was just this massive contrast between those two things. And where your standards lie in that definitely is an individual thing and an individual question. And I wouldn't like judge anyone who didn't want to see this movie because of that or wants to wait for it to be filtered. But for me, it didn't bother me as much as, like I said, some other portrayals have.
I would hope we could all agree that even in movies that depict sex and the sexual act, there is a spectrum between something that is trying to portray this part of human experience and something that is just raw pornography that is just trying to titillate and get people excited and bring them into it in a way that they shouldn't. And this was definitely more on the former end of the spectrum. Not super glamorous, shows the emotional devastation, especially to Kitty, while they're grilling him about this. As far as my personal tastes go, I felt it was gratuitous. I don't think we needed to see it. Although I recognize, again, it was the more artistic side than the pornographic side. I would be hard pressed, I think, in my sensibilities. And I recognize that they are mine, but I think I'm relatively mainstream Latter-day Saint. I think I would be hard pressed to find an experience of portraying the sexual act on screen that I would be like, oh yes, that's the only way you could have done that. And so I come to it with that predisposition. And so I felt it was unnecessary. And yet it helped cinematically portray this part of his life that was not a happy part of his life. So I don't know, do with that what you will. As far as just the general point of R-rated movies and that ongoing eternal discussion among Latter-day Saints forever, it will go on until kingdom come. But as for myself, I don't outsource my values to the MPAA board. I appreciate that it is a board. I appreciate that it is there. I like the idea that the only requirement to be on their board is that you have to be a parent. But I had a friend of mine from Canada who came to BYU and he was like, oh, shoot, all these movies I've been watching are rated R because the Canadian system does not match up with the U.S. system 1-to-1.
Yeah, I had an experience like that too with my Canadian roommate. She's like, I saw it with my young women's group.
And especially as the church becomes more international, like a hard and fast rule like that doesn't feel quite appropriate, but your mileage may vary. And I have one friend in that same Discord server that Liz was just talking about who basically said, I've just decided I don't watch anything higher than PG. I think it was PG. Like, she just doesn't watch anything higher than PG. And she has found that has really helped her media consumption and stay in the spiritual wavelengths that she wants to. And so, you know what? More power to her. I don't find it that quite accords with my sensibilities, but I could be wrong.
Another interesting thing from that discussion was one person brought up that once he sees an image in his head, it is in his head forever. And I am on the opposite end of that spectrum where I don't have a visual imagination at all. Like, I do not recall images. I have aphantasia. I don't visualize things at all. My dreams have like dialogue tags that are written out. That's how
fascinating.
I'm really weird. But I think that is a factor that we don't talk about. If you're the kind of person who images flash in your mind once you've seen them and they stay there, then you probably have to be more careful about the things. And it matters more to you than it does to somebody who's not as affected by that. So yeah, there's definitely so many factors and it's definitely an individual decision.
So your dreams literally have subtitles? That's amazing.
Yeah, yeah. It's very weird.
My co-author has aphantasia as well. And I don't have it. I actually have hyperphantasia, which means that I see everything. Like, I'll be somewhere and I don't see like where I am. But it's really fascinating. Pretty cool to talk about it. Kind of have that opposite.
Yeah, I remember when they were first coming out with like trailers for the Harry Potter movies and everybody was like, oh, this actor looks terrible or whatever. And I was like, oh, Harry Potter has black hair. I didn't know that.
Maybe just to return a little bit to the thoughts that we were having about like level of appropriateness. When I went to college for my undergraduate degree at a church school, I had to take a film class for my degree. And there were several rated R movies that we had to watch. And up until that point, I had not watched a lot. My household was not that strict growing up. So it was never like I was forbidden from it. They just weren't movies that I was interested in. And my teacher was like, rated R movies are part of cinematic history. This is just, it is what it is. And then he said, I remember he like had said some things about the original talk was that they had talked about rated R movies that it just talked about content. And I was like, well, I mean, that's kind of the same. But I feel like as an adult, I tend to watch a lot of things and not necessarily look at the rating system. And this is like my personal view. I really like that you guys say it's like up to different people because I speak to a lot of people and some people are have one comfort level and I think that's completely appropriate. But a lot of people have like much less of a comfort level. And I think I tend to fall into that. This is my opinion for myself. I don't think that seeing rated R movies personally impedes me from having a relationship with my creator or with my savior either. I think it's okay for people to be in different places with that. I don't. So that's all I would add to that conversation. And anyone is free to like disagree with me on that. I'm not trying to put down doctrine or anything, but I think that's maybe a perspective that people don't hear as often.
Let's move on to one of the other things we discussed in our show notes as we were collecting thoughts to talk about. Liz, you mentioned that this caused a bit of a stir in India because of the use of the scripture from the Bhagavad Gita, I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. And also the poem, the Trinity test itself and where that name comes from, the use of religious imagery in something that is so terrible in the original sense of the word terrible, not necessarily a negative, but an awe-inspiring, awesome way.
Or in this case, terror.
Like, there's a quote where he says it would be a manifestation of terrible divine power when he's talking about the column of fire in Japan that would come up. So yeah, he uses those actual words from scriptures and stuff as well several times.
The other religious component, I think, is Oppenheimer and Strauss's Jewishness, the way that plays out or is subtext in a lot of the movie.
I was surprised it didn't get called out when they're having this Christmas party at the base.
But I remember my grandpa was Jewish. And I remember that they celebrated Christmas too. So I think that actually might be an aspect of culturalism in that time period.
But they did call it out a few times at the beginning of the movie. The best way we're going to get people for this project is all the Jews who are fleeing Europe right now. Let's snatch up all the scientists and give them a job over here.
Liz, do you know why exactly? What about the use of the Bhagavad Gita in the film caused controversy? Is it that it's wrapped up in sex and nudity?
I believe so. I think they felt like she brings him the book to translate as if this is something they're doing while they're having sex, which is super weird. So it was a strange way to work that quote into it. I was just trying to think of, I can't think of a similar instance for Latter-day Saints to try to figure out how I would feel about it because I don't have this connection to the Bhagavad Gita. I'm more familiar with that quote from nuclear testing. And so it doesn't have that resonance with me. And so I was trying to think of something that would help me understand how people were feeling about that. I couldn't think of anything.
I think this is a cultural difference between us and India as well. I don't remember what movie it was, but I remember it was about the actor, Richard Gere, who had starred in something with some Bollywood Indian actress who was one of their stars at the time. And at one of the press tours, he kissed her. And that was like very culturally offensive in India, because in India, even kissing in public is seen as part of the sexual act. And so he had just basically started to have sex with her by kissing her on the part of this press tour. And he had to like formally apologize and explain that he didn't mean the offense and apologize to her and to all the Indian people. And so when you have that mindset on the front of what you're considering, bringing this quote in to that particular scene maybe makes a little more sense of why Indians were like, whoa, wait a minute, what are you doing here? If it had just been Oppenheimer whispering that under his breath as the Trinity mushroom cloud is ascending into the sky, I don't know that it would have had the same, that would have been banned in India for the same reasons. So it's not just the use of scripture, it's putting it in that context that is even more culturally fraught because of Indian mores around sex.
From one of my friends who is Indian, we talked a little bit about it and she explained the context behind like the part of the scripture where they talk about it with soldiers and Krishna and everything, and this concept of what it means. And the idea is like self-sacrifice and destruction. I don't think that necessarily needed to be done. I'm not making that point. But to provide context based from the book, Jean Tatlock was a pretty staunch atheist, but extremely dogmatic communist. And there's some quotes from her. So like one of the quotes she said, she's like, I don't think I could keep living if I didn't think that life in Russia was better than it was in the U.S. Like that was the perspective that she had when talking and with interacting, right? Like it's a unique perspective, I would say the least. But the thing about her as well is she was actually bisexual and was only attracted to men through saposexualism or sexuality, which is attraction to people who are smart, demonstrating intellect. I don't agree with it, but I understand the point that they were trying to make about the person that she was. This is only going to work for me to see like this brilliant mind. And that's another reason why there was so much rejection. I believe that he had proposed to her somewhere like around 20 times, like in the time that they had been dating and stuff. And in the show, it shows the flowers, but he had actually done it publicly and privately and was like, please marry me. And the Communist Party was vying for it because it was like royalty, like communist royalty in their eyes saying it. Even though he was not a communist, he was so emblematic of their party because of how smart he was, like, and how much he could do and how much he could understand. So with the use of scripture within that, I mean, I think in its most simplest sense, it could be like said as like sacrilege, right? Like, I can think of specific examples that I have seen in my time as a Latter-day Saint that could compare to how I would feel about it as like an Indian would feel about seeing sacred scripture there being used. But, so I recognize the outrage and I think that it's justified for those people because a mockery of sacred things is not something that's taken lightly by many people who hold those things sacred. So I don't think that it was a good choice to make. I understand, I think, why the choice was made, but I honestly think that India was justified in choosing to do that. And a lot of people felt the effects of that because it hurts. I genuinely believe it hurts people who hold things sacred when somebody desecrates them.
What's the Indian version of VidAngel? Is it going to cut the quote of the Bhagavad Gita out? Or just the whole scene because there's nudity and sex going on.
They cut the whole scene and it wouldn't be available for them. So in the release there, they had to cut out the entire sections.
The whole scene? All right, there you go.
It's just not available. Yeah.
But it is interesting to see that this is a side of Oppenheimer I didn't know, that he's like super literary. And when I was looking up, like, why did they use this quote? And the thing that mystified me more was when the John Donne poem showed up and was the justification for the name Trinity for the test. I was like, that's John Donne. What is that doing in here? But apparently Oppenheimer was a very literary guy. And we've got this article that we'll link in the show notes about his reading list is like T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland and The Divine Comedy and the Bhagavad Gita and Plato. And this, oh, okay. This is a whole nother side to him that I had no idea.
Yeah, that's how him and Jean came together, because she had gotten her master's degree in literary studies. So they would like talk about those things. I understand why like they would try to go for that angle, but they could have probably picked a lot of other books, maybe, or other quotes, but I think thematically that was their choice.
The last thing I wanted to talk about was just the whole idea of nuclear weapons in general. Again, I found it thematically scattershot. It's there when this would be horrifying. And then it disappears. And then when he's giving the speech after the successful Trinity test, he watches as the audience in front of him begins to burn and feel the effects of a nuclear blast in his mind's eye. And then just at the very end of the movie, when he sees something out of a Terminator movie with all the nuclear weapons flying around and blowing the Earth up, this is something that it does try to wrestle with. We have created, in harnessing these very building blocks of creation, these absolutely horrifying weapons. And I thought it did a good job, at least on this front, of showing Oppenheimer being just the, oh, this is just a theory. We're just going to try to build this thing. And then confronting the reality of what he's created and how it has been used and what it might do to humanity in the future. I thought it did a pretty good job. Did anybody else have thoughts on this, the very uncontroversial subject of nuclear war and nuclear weapons and these things we've created that could wipe out humanity and destroy the planet?
One of my biggest reservations about the film before seeing it was that it would glorify Oppenheimer and justify the use of nuclear weapons. So I was quite pleasantly surprised, I guess, at the more ambivalent position the film seems to take. And I guess it's hard for me to tease out what exactly the film's position is versus what like pieces I'm just like honing in on because they align with my own personal viewpoint that I brought to the film. I think that scene of the speech after the test and the ways that once you see that scene, you realize that he's been having earlier in the film, but later chronologically, he'd been having PTSD type flashbacks of that experience, like throughout the whole film. And whether it's just the subtle things of him hearing these stomping feet that aren't present, but are like overlaid. Anyway, that really worked for me, the ways that it dramatized this experience that he had. And one of the fascinating things about the film is it seems like you can make the clearest case for it being opposed to the current widespread existence of nuclear weapons. That is like this existential threat to humanity. It seems more ambivalent about the use of the bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. There's a line that's almost a throwaway line where the Oppenheimer says something about like it helped end the war, and then someone else says, the intelligence was they were going to surrender anyway. We didn't need it. But it was a sort of blink and you miss it type nod. For my personal taste, I wish it had played up that piece a little bit more to speak to some of Carl's points about thematic messiness. I think one of the things that gets really messy is that at the same time, it's posing the sort of critique of at least the fruits of Oppenheimer's work. It seems to be trying to vindicate Oppenheimer in this sort of political prosecution courtroom drama stuff. And that those are woven together in the final act of the film, I think leaves a pretty complicated result. That worked for me, but I can understand why you would want it to be more unified in the end, when it seems at the end instead to be, oh yeah, maybe it was a bad thing this guy did this, but we absolutely should not have taken away his security clearance for these like nefarious reasons that were mostly dubious. And then throws those at you together is a strange choice. But I'm still not quite sure what like the intent, I guess, of structuring it that way was.
I think we all agree at this point that Christopher Nolan doesn't think in linear terms. You liked it?
I'm sorry, everyone. I feel like I like this.
No, we like a good debate. Go for it.
I don't like being moralized at. And you might be like, well, but you're religious. I don't like people telling me how to think about situations. So I really like the way that they talked about Oppenheimer, which is why I went on to read the book, because I was like, okay, well, I need to know more about this subject.
So did you watch the movie and then go read the book?
Yes. I watched the movie once in English, I watched it in Spanish, and then I read the book, and then I saw it again in English. And yeah, anyways, that was the timeline of me with Oppenheimer. When I read it, I was like, oh, I need to know more about this because this is something that intrigues me. Each time I left it, I saw more ambiguity in the position of Oppenheimer. And I love the line at the end when him and his wife are walking inside and she's like, you think because you've suffered so much that they'll forgive you. And I feel like there's layers to that. On the one hand, where you recognize how bad it was, but they didn't radicalize you, tell how bad it was. They did not show the pictures of the survivors. They did not do a lot of things that they could have done to radicalize you on one opinion or the other. And that's why I was like, I need to know more about this. And I feel that way a lot. I have had my moments of like deep dives, for example, to bring it into religious context. On church history, I don't really like hermeneutics in a lot of cases. I like to read source texts, and then I like to ingest into myself what I'm reading, and then I like to formulate opinions. That's like my personal process on things. So with Oppenheimer, it humanizes him at the very least, where you're like, this is where he felt. I see that he had remorse, but it doesn't necessarily mean that he regrets it. And that's something that's also very poignant about the final battle with the prosecutor. It's like, so you had moral qualms after you did this, but before you did not. If you had to go back and do it again, would you have done it again? And I really do believe that Oppenheimer was not, oh, it's so good because like you can apply this to anything. Like, I don't like Joseph Smith, for example, like it's so easy for some people to be like, I think he was this and this and this. And then some people to think he's the opposite. Whereas like when you spend so much time searching into these aspects of messy church history, you're like, maybe it's in the middle a little bit, right? And you start to formulate opinions about what actually happened, or biblical studies as well. Because when you look at him, I do think that he wanted to be famous. I do think that he was driven by ambition quite a lot leading up to this project. I do think that he was egotistical. I think that he was vain. I think that he was incredibly selfish. I do think that what happened changed him. I don't know if I think that he's vindicated because he felt bad about creating something that killed a massive amount of people. And that's why I like it. Because it's like, I get to spend a lot of time looking at it and it doesn't give me the answer. I have to find the answer. And I, from my own personal human journey, it feels like this is what it's about, is understanding morality. And that's what attracts me about the philosophical aspects of it as well, because it uses religious terms, it uses some of these things, but it doesn't give you answers.
That scene with Kitty is so good. I like the way that as he's walking inside, he turns and has this little glint in his eye. And wait, is that, are you admitting that this is all just a con? And you like, don't feel bad at all? Or something else happening? But yeah. And just that Cillian Murphy can convey both this depth
the fairy
and
print.
You're unable to access it. That you're looking at it and you're like, there's so much happening inside of you and you're not showing me what it is. That, I don't know, it's so compelling.
I would love to see somebody go through and compile how much of this movie is just staring at that guy's face with an ambiguous emotion on it. And you're just like, and you don't care at all. It's 3 hours and so much of it. You're just staring at his face and you're just like, what is this guy thinking? And I wanted to touch again on something that Connor said. I think a perfect term is the ambivalence in this film. There's this feeling that if we don't invent it, someone else will. And I pulled out my phone in the movie theater to write down this quote from it. There were only four of us. It was 11:50 in the morning. It's one of the other scientists talking to Oppenheimer. He says, "I don't wish for the culmination of three centuries of physics to be a weapon of mass destruction." But then there's no way out of it, right? They have no way to stop what has been set in motion. And there's just like this feeling that we're discovering this really cool thing and we cannot stop the fact that it is going to be a really destructive thing. But we are forced to discover it anyway, because if we don't, someone else will. And we hate this. And yet we love this because it's fascinating and we're doing something so cool and yet so terrible. And just this agony of how to deal with this. And the fact that now that we know that you can make nuclear weapons, we can't unknow that as a human race. It's not something we can undo.
I think that's a repetitive moral problem.
I love the line where it's, "I don't know if we can be trusted with this weapon, but I know the Nazis cannot," which really informs like the desire to create this. And I love the sort of, there's a little throwaway line when they're talking about the, can we destroy the entire planet with the chain reaction that wipes out everything? They're like, if we discover that we're going to, we need to figure out some way to tell the Nazis so they don't test the bomb and blow the world up.
That's what Einstein says. He's like, what if we discover that it's going to blow up the world? And he said, then you tell the Nazis and you keep each other from destroying everything.
So fascinating to be wrestling with these kinds of questions of, anyway, of, yeah. We look at it, we're like, oh, look at those couple hundred thousand people who died. But they're like, could we eradicate the Earth? So interesting to see, what does that do to a person?
I feel like, from an artistic standpoint, I really feel like it was intentional, not only because of the acting capacity of Cillian Murphy, but in those moments, what were you doing? Like, obviously you're staring at him, but you were thinking, right? You were having moments of introspection while you're watching here. Like, what is he thinking? And then all of a sudden you have to ground yourself inside of the movie, which is why I think it works so well, because you're throughout the movie, you're having a philosophical and existential crisis. Like, for 3 hours, you're like, what is morality? What is good? Is this justified? And looking back now, I think, like, potentially in a lot of the climate that is, like, the U.S. culture of, like, is the U.S. justified in so much of what it's done in destruction? Like, all of these things, like, people are sitting there and just having to confront them for 3 hours. And I think that's one of the powers of the movie as well. Back to what I said at the beginning, like, have to seek for the truth. When you watch things like this and you're like, what is truth? What do I find in this movie that is actually true? It's something so horrible, because Oppenheimer was not a savior. The tendency from the movie is it almost pushes you that direction a little bit, like from the way that it's filmed, but then from the actions themselves, it pulls you back and says, but no, actually not. And there's the whole thing with Nazis and the Judaism of the main characters of, I keep thinking of Salieri and Mozart, but it's Oppenheimer and Strauss, where they're like dealing with the effects of this is their family. And Oppenheimer speaks of that openly. He says, my family, these are my colleagues, this is my culture, my people that are dying. And that's why, one of the reasons why he created the nuclear weapon was to save his people. But then in the end, it was not used for that. It was used against a limping enemy. And the thing is, and I'm putting this again into cultural context, think about who the Japanese were at that moment. I spent several years working with Chinese students and like working for people in China. And there's a lot of hatred towards the Japanese. I was shocked by it the first time I encountered it. I had a 5-year-old student tell me that the Japanese had pointy teeth and they were evil. That was their description of them. Because of things like the Rape of Nanking, because of what Japan did in the Asian part of the world at that time, a lot of people looked at that act and saw it as something good. But we look at it now, it's genocide. Genocide is wrong. But like, when you continue to put in more and more of these layers, you begin to understand what it is to be human and deal with the weight of how messy and horrific actions can be. And that's one of the reasons why I think this movie is so powerful, because it, again, like, it just, it makes you confront everything like that.
Yeah, that is a great place to end our discussion. Thank you all so much for all your thoughts and comments. This has been wonderful. We're going to close with our ratings segment, though, where we go through three different ways of looking and viewing at the movie. It's our way of evaluating the movie on a couple of different scales. And so our first rating is content. is this a clean movie you could go see with your friends and family and your grandma and your kids versus objectionable material? And we rate it according to the Latter-day Saint afterlife: celestial, terrestrial, telestial, and outer darkness. And I'm just curious how the three of you rated. We always get into trouble with this one.
We're not going to agree on this one, and that's okay.
I don't know how to do that one, because then I was looking at it, I was like, oh, this is so cute, but or like funny, but...
It was cute when we made it up, and now it's become really serious.
I was like, is it like modeling celestial societies? Because no, but like...
I'll tell you where I am going to go with content.
Yeah, Liz, go ahead. You start, because you created the system, like...
I know, it's my fault. I've created this monster. But I'm going to put it in the telestial, and it's because the telestial is the world in which we now live. And this is very much a fallen world movie. And that's why I'm going to put it there.
I think I would agree with that personally. The way the world is, all the problems and the messiness and the complications that we have and the horrors we visit upon each other, sometimes in the name of preventing a greater horror, it's just... Man, this is Satan reigning with blood and horror on this earth.
Although less war horror than I anticipated. As Daniela pointed out, they went out of their way not to show any of the carnage. And I was bracing myself for that. And there's only this imagined scene where he sees a little bit of it happen to his colleagues and then they just disappear.
And then they have the scene where they show them the aftermath, though. But like in that moment where they're showing a slideshow, like they show him like looking away and everybody gasping. That was one of the scenes in particular I was seeking about that comment.
Something you should not do for your ninth grade world history final paper is read the book just titled Hiroshima, the one that won the Pulitzer Prize like in 1950
oh, no.
or whatever. I read that book, and that's the book I did my final paper on for my world history class in ninth grade, and it's horrifying.
Well, I think based on that rating system, I think Telestial would probably be the best. But I'm going to say something a little controversial and say that I don't know if like a Celestial movie would be that fun to watch. As not celestial beings.
Good caveat.
We've had that conversation several times. Can you divorce the artistic value of the movie from its content? That's part of why we have these three axes to rate a movie on. So our second category is artistic merit. Skillful, effective use of craft, 1 to 5 popcorn balls. I'll lead off on this one. It should have had a bit of a warning for those of you who don't like strobe lights or whatever, because my friend who came and saw it with me had to leave the theater because he was going to be sick, because it was intense for him just on a visual level there in the IMAX theater with all the sound and the popping of the electrons and all the sort of stuff like that. But so I thought it was interesting. I always do like that Christopher Nolan does everything practical. And when I read that, I was like, wait, you're going to do practical effects for a movie about the first atomic bomb? We've already mentioned that the acting is really good. The themes, obviously, interesting. I have some quibble about the themes running through and not being consistent, being brought up and dropped and then brought up again. I can still have that complaint and still think that this was a good movie that made me think. So I'm going to give it 5 popcorn balls. Connor, I'll let you take the next one this time. 1 to 5 popcorn balls. What would you give this movie?
A little 5. I think it's, yeah, great.
All right. I suppose I should have known you were going to say that. You're like, this is my favorite movie so far this year. So, anyway. Daniela, what would you give this one on 1 to 5 popcorn balls?
Definitely 5.
All right. Yeah. Liz.
I'm going to do 4 with the option to go to 5. I only saw this film 2 days ago, so I'm still like processing. I'm going to figure out, like Connor pointed out, the ending is interesting because we end almost completely divorced from the actual invention of the atomic bomb to this question about his security clearance. The last half hour of the movie is all about that, and I'm not sure what to think about that yet. So I got to think a little bit more. So I'm going to go 4, option 5.
Sure. Fair enough.
I invented the rating system. I can break it however I want.
That's right. It's your baby. You do what you need to. And our final rating is Gospel Connections, Morally Edifying Messages. I think, well, okay, let's have Daniela lead out on this one, because I'm curious.
Oh, no.
I'm curious to see what she does with this idea of a morally edifying message.
Oh, no.
That's not very nice of you, Carl.
Okay, so morally edifying message. I already said that it doesn't moralize to you. So if I'm rating it of whether or not it teaches you a good lesson.
But sometimes we also give high ratings to films that bring up good discussions. And I feel like this is definitely a discussion-worthy movie. Like, you basically can't see this movie and not talk to anybody about it. You have to.
you have to talk about what you feel about it and what they thought about it and like these things. And then it brings up like all kinds of emotions. The process that I've had to take to look at the story and through the movie and come to some of these conclusions and also come to like some not conclusions. I would say for me, it was extremely morally edifying. So I would give it 5 apricots because of all the things that I've already talked about today. Like this was a movie that was really meaningful for me, that really hooked me and captivated me. And that's not something I experience often. And it always happens with the strangest films. Like the one before this was like Emma. I don't know if you guys have seen the Emma movie. The Jane Austen one that they did with the girl from The Queen's Gambit.
And it's Anya Taylor-Joy.
Yeah, exactly. There are these moments where it just brings something out of me and it makes me feel so much and it makes me reflect so much. So I would say 5, but there's no, I guess it's a rating system, so there's no right or wrong answers. So.
Absolutely. There's not a right or wrong answer. Connor, what would you give this one from 1 to 5 apricots?
Thinking about it, pretty similar to Daniela. We'll do 4, 4.5. Because I think the thematic messiness probably like undercuts slightly some of my experience with it, but I think overall definitely on the upper echelon of the apricots.
Liz, what are you going to give it?
I don't know. It really is tough. I think I might give it a 3 because it is very much a puzzle box. Like you have to sit with it and think about it. It's definitely something you have to morally engage with, but it doesn't give you any direct answers about it. I don't know. I felt like the movie itself doesn't say a lot of those things. And maybe that's a good thing from Daniela's perspective. You're right. But for me personally, yeah, I feel like I'm going to have to go outside of the movie to engage more with this question. I don't feel satisfied with the engagement of the movie with the issue. So I'm going to give it a 3. And it's also not a very redemptive movie. I don't think I like any of the people in this movie very much.
I would die for Kitty Oppenheimer.
Okay.
Just going to say that. And by the way, she's also like the niece of a prince, like of like German prince and stuff. That's something they don't get into as well, but she's like royalty. And she was married at the time when they met with Gene, but he was also seeing someone else that wasn't Gene. And she like crashed a party wearing like a fancy seductive dress. And they got together. So that's something else about her. I really like her. I think she's a complex person. I think they show nuance in women that's not very common, especially for Christopher Nolan, who's like the haunted dead wife man. Like all of his movies, it's always like some woman that sounds weird to motivate the protagonist. You know, I don't know. I love her.
The mentally fridged wife.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
So I'm going to be a little contrarian and give this 2 apricots. Not because of the moral complexity, because I think you've all hit it on the head that it brings up issues that you cannot help but wrestle with. And in that way, it is a movie that is consumed by morality and moral questions. I was listening to a political podcast where they talked about it briefly, and one of the guys just said he did not like the movie because it never wrestled with the question of whether they should have dropped or that it only barely touched on the issue of whether they should have dropped them on Japan or not. It's there for sort of 5 minutes in the movie. And to him, that was the only question worth asking about this event in human history. And rightfully, I think some of the other people on the podcast got after him for talking about all these other things that the movie brings up that was really good. But as far as the definition of a morally edifying message, I have to agree with Liz, like it doesn't come down because it's so ambiguous and there's so much that it doesn't quite ever pick a side on. I can't say that I'm going to think this is a morally edifying movie, even though it is a fantastic movie to get you to think about moral issues. So that's why I'm going to give it 2 apricots. And that's maybe just a different use of what this is, which is why I wanted Daniela to go first. Sometimes our discussion of the rating system itself garners some good insights. So thank you all very much. Thank you all for joining us on this episode of Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree. I'm on Twitter at Carl Cranny, or X, I guess now it's called. I'm not tweeting. I'm Xing. I'm expounding. I don't know what I'm doing there anymore, but that's where you can find me. Sure. I'm at Carl Cranny. Liz, where could people get in touch with you if they wanted to?
You can follow my writing and book reviews and graduate school musings at lizbusby.com.
All right. Connor, if people wanted to reach out to you, where could they find you on social media or anything else you'd like to plug? I was fascinated by that article about you and your wife in the Salt Lake Tribune.
Oh, yeah. There is an article about me in the Salt Lake Tribune. I mean, that probably easiest place to get in touch and still Twitter-ish, but not there very often. At the Connor Hilton. That's also my handle, like Blue Sky and other places if they end up replacing Twitter.
And Daniela, where could people reach out and get in touch with you if they wanted to?
The easiest place would probably be through Instagram at authordaniela.a.mera. I also have a website at danielaamera.com, and I check my email pretty regularly. So either of those two places.
Thanks for joining us this week. If you've enjoyed this episode, please share the podcast with a friend who enjoys good movies and good conversation. You can also subscribe on the podcast platform of your choice or on YouTube. We'd love to hear your thoughts on this episode via email, social media, or on our website. It really makes our day as podcast hosts to hear from you, our listeners. Liz, can you tell us what we'll be discussing in our next episode?
Next time, as you might guess, we'll be completing our Barbenheimer miniseries by discussing Barbie, the summer blockbuster film about the plastic doll that everyone loves or loves to hate, directed by Greta Gerwig. If you've been following all the hot takes, you know there are a lot of questions about what this film means for the world. And we've got some opinions on the matter, so be ready for that conversation in 2 weeks. This has been Pop Culture on the Apricot Tree, encouraging you to seek after everything virtuous, lovely, of good report, or praiseworthy. See you next time.